name of this talk because it's not really about sendmail per se. Sendmail is kind of a case study here. It's really about how systems evolve over time. This is a keynote presentation that I did for Linux Conference Australia. So you guys are the second ones who get to see this. So the question is, well, this is actually from the old title, but you know, why is sendmail interesting? Well, it's an old program. It has survived remarkably well. It has changed the world in some fundamental sense. It was created without any corporate support. It thrived in a rapidly changing world. I mean, really rapidly changing. You know, how did it happen? That's actually kind of an interesting question. So let's start off. This is going to be kind of two parts. I'm going to try and go through the first part quickly because it's the boring part. And then we'll get to part two. A bit of background. It was written in 1980, thereabouts. It had no official support, even from the university. I was supposed to be working on relational database management research at the time. This is before relational database systems existed, just to put it in context. The internet did not exist, and I didn't do it because I wanted to do it. I did it because I had to do it. So let me give you a little perspective about what the world was like in 1980. I'm just guessing that a few of you don't remember this. CPUs were, on the whole, 16 bits, thereabouts. They were less than 1 MIPS, million instructions per second, for those of you who haven't heard of that. Disks were substantially less than 1 gigabyte. They were the size of refrigerators. I remember, since we were on a database project, the day when the sum of all of our disk drives got to an entire gigabyte of disk space because we were working on very large databases, and we asked ourselves where we were going to find enough data to be able to fill that. Memory was substantially less than 1 megabyte. You definitely measured memory in kilobytes. The networks, fast networks, were 50, topped out at 56 kilobits per second, about a dial-up modem today. Ethernet existed in the labs at Park, but it wasn't really out there. Relational databases were a research novelty. Mobile phones existed, but they were these huge brick things like you've probably seen in movies and very expensive, and cameras used film. In contrast, the world today, CPUs, commodity CPUs, are 64 bits. They're substantially larger than 50,000 MIPS in approximate equivalent. Disks, a 2-terabyte disk will fit in your back pocket. Memory, 100 gigabytes and up. Network, megabit ranges on DSL are easy. An OC3072 is 160 gigabit. No SQL is hot, relational database systems are boring, phones are tiny, ubiquitous, and effectively free, and the cameras are digital included in that phone. This is where I started. This was the architecture of the mail system on Unix version 6 in 1980. There was a network called UUCP that was a dial-up based network. Bin mail was the mail program on Unix. There were no others. And bin mail could send stuff off to UUX, which had its own outgoing spool, and there was a local mail spool. And the star, I couldn't come up with a graphic that didn't really totally suck as for the user. So the star is the user. We had a machine, Ernie Kovacs, which is a VAX 11780. For those of you who live in Silicon Valley, you can see one in the Computer History Museum. There were more ASCII terminals in people's offices than there were ports on the machine, because ports were really expensive. So they had a patch panel in the mail room, so you could go in and plug your terminal into one of the available ports, assuming there was one. And we had about a dozen Unix machines around the campus that were networked with another TTY-based network called BerkNet that was written by a student at Berkeley whose name is also Eric, but he's gone on to substantially richer things than I have. That is to say, he just stepped down as CEO of Google. The problem was that the Ingress relational database project got an ARPANET connection, which was the predecessor to the internet, and everyone in the department wanted access to this. Now, we had a PDP 1170, so it wasn't even as big as that VAX that everyone else was using. We only had two TTY ports available for everyone in the department to share. And so the thing, remember that plug board in the mailroom, people would go out and pull somebody else's port out and plug their own in. And I exaggerate, but only barely, about the fist fights in the mailroom. And of course, everyone complained to me because I was kind of the de facto sysad on that machine at the time, because I was the one who got the ARPANET connection in. So what I noted was, you know, there were two protocols on the network back then. Well, three, sort of. There was Telnet, remote login. There was FTP, file copy. And, by the way, FTP could also do email. But what I noticed was everyone actually wanted to do email. They didn't want Telnet. They didn't want to actually copy files. They just wanted email. And so, you know, we had a network connecting the machines together. So if I just forwarded the mail between them, I could get these professors off my butt. So, you know, it's just a little bit of software. How hard can it be? The routing decisions were easy. They were based on punctuation characters and addresses, you know, at signs versus exclamation points. And so I ended up building this. At this point, this is with the ARPANET. This column over here is the ARPANET architecture with the FTP outgoing here, a spool file. There was an incoming mail spool, so forth. Here's the user. And then we, at that point, had UCB mail, which was an MUA done at Berkeley. And we had the BerkNet mailer that was kind of hacked in here. And bin mail was the one that had all of the knowledge about everything. And, oh, by the way, also had to manage the mail spool and had to be the user interface and so forth. And, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate BSDCAN without some code. This is actual code out of bin mail from the time. I have found three bugs or potential bugs in these, what is it, 9 lines of code. Node Research was the name of the node at Bell Labs. So basically this one node name was compiled into the code. It was pretty ad hoc back then. So when I did deliver mail, I had a few design principles. First of all, I was, you know, doing this in my spare time. I was finite. I didn't want to redesign user agents. Even back then, people were starting to get passionate about it. I didn't want to redesign the local mail store because that would mean fixing the user agents. I decided the right thing to do is to make deliver mail adapt to the world, not the other way around. It turns out other work that was being done on mailers right then took the opposite attitude. And I wanted to change as little as possible. So pretty much here's what it looked like afterwards. You had deliver mail, UCB mail talked to deliver mail. There was still this mail spool that UCB mail dealt with directly, and bin mail dealt with directly. But deliver mail called bin mail and vice versa. So deliver mail was supposed to, you know, get the mail out there. And everything ended up calling deliver mail. Notice in the previous one, the ARPANET column and everything else didn't talk to each other. Now they did. The world is happy, and this talk is over. There were some problems with the solution. It was inflexible. You actually had to recompile it on various machines to configure it. There was no address translation between networks, so the message just went through, typically you couldn't reply to them. The address parsing was extremely simplistic, and yet, despite its simplisticness, it was also opaque. It was supposed to be a quick hack. It was. Solved the immediate problem. To give you an idea of how bad this thing was at the time, here's... So if you kind of figure out what SendMail calls a net, you could call it a mailer or whatever, and a host and a user. Foo at bar obviously goes to the ARPANET, host bar user foo. Foo colon bar was the BerkNet syntax. UECP used exclamation points. This one could resolve to two things, depending on whether you were foo or not. There was this kind of weird syntax where percents could double as at signs. And then foo bang bar at baz, since some were left associative and some were right associative, was Well, you couldn't really tell. That was just heuristics at that point. And this actually is a legal address, or was a legal address, Fu Bang Bar, colon, Baz, Hat, Fritz, at Frotts. And your guess is as good as mine what it actually means. There's an entire book written just about addressing mail at the time, just to give you an idea. So, you know, something had to happen. Berkeley was awarded a DARPA contract to do a research platform, which turned into 4.2 BSD. Bill Joy talked me into doing this because they needed somebody to do the mailer. I knew more about the mail system than anyone else. Convinced me that this was going to be a small job, if I'd only known. Did require adding SMTP support. That wouldn't be too hard if the SMTP protocol actually existed at the time, but it was not written yet. But we kind of knew what it was going to be like. I could have done it as an outboard process and fit it into the deliver mail model of the world, but that would require that I have an internal protocol. I couldn't, exit statuses weren't a rich enough language to be able to get everything across, and so I'd have to create an internal protocol which would look a lot like SMTP. So if I'm going to implement SMTP anyway, I might as well just implement SMTP. Implementing SMTP forced the introduction of a queue. Prior to that, each mail channel had its own queue. And queues turn out to be a lot harder than they look. So major new features in SendMail, header rewriting so you could actually reply to mail, SMTP support, queuing, and runtime configuration. DeliverMail didn't have runtime configuration partially because A, it was a quick hack, and B, it ran on 16-bit machines, some of which had, you know, 40K of main memory. And so you had to keep it as small as possible. SendMail was released in 1982 in 4.1A BSD, which was a kind of beta release. And this is what the architecture looked like then. It's very similar to what we had before with SendMail in the place of DeliverMail, except that there's now a queue over here, and there's the SMTP, and it talks to the internet directly. And then things like MH were coming along, and they used SMTP. And you notice there's more of a, people are not so much using mail.local or bin mail as a user interface anymore, so the delivery part got pulled out into mail.local. So you're starting to see the development of the concept of the message store as a first-class citizen. So in 1981, I left Berkeley for what was supposed to have been a lucrative career in industry. I would be rich and retired by the time I was 30. That didn't work out. But I was at a startup, and SendMail was picked up by most of the vendors as of Unix-based systems. Unix was exploding then. Every vendor, you know, since they... All the vendors, of course, instantly got open source. They had to customize Unix to make it intentionally incompatible with everyone else's version of Unix so that they could have their vendor lock-in, because that's just the way you did business. And so many versions of SendMail and everything else sprung up. It was a pretty messy world. In 1989, I came back to Berkeley. There were some minor tweaks in SendMail that needed to be done to create the CS subdomain, because at that point, up until then, Berkeley was a completely flat domain. It was just host.berkeley.edu. As I tweaked that, I got pissed off at the configuration. As I tweaked the configuration, I got pissed off at the code, and it all turned into a major rewrite, which resulted in SendMail 8. Now, SendMail 8... effectively took all of these various code lines that had diverged out there and tried to bring them back together. You know, the motto is steal from the best. You go and you look from the at what the vendors did. Some of them actually came up with good ideas. Most of them were really bad, and so you wanted to get rid of that, but there were some. The open source community had done some extremely good work as well. IDA SendMail from Sweden was mostly a configuration package, and they did some very good things. I grabbed a lot of it. I probably should have grabbed more of it in retrospect. And Paul Vixie had done something he was calling King James SendMail, KJS, which was supposed to be that grand unifying version, but his unfortunately didn't work on that. A lot was about configuration, but there were code changes. There had been a major revision of SMTP, which was codified in RFCs 1123 and 2821. There were new protocols such as delivery status notifications. There was more integration with the rest of the world. The map paradigm in SendMail was really a generic hook into other services. There needed to be support for 8-bit mail. Increasingly, the people, for some reason, in countries outside of North America felt a need to communicate with each other in their own language, which I think is weird. But and there was a new configuration package. The other big thing that happened with SendMail 8, though, which I can't emphasize enough, was the BAT book. The BAT book dramatically improved the visibility and uptake on SendMail 8. Documentation really does count. As the net grew and SendMail remains popular, I was spending more and more of my time supporting it. Supporting it turned more and more into, responding with the number of the item in the FAQ that they should have read. It was getting more and more boring. And I wanted to get back to coding, so in 1998, I founded SendMail Inc., and the idea was to produce a commercial version. I could hire somebody to do this mindless support. I could get back to coding. The reality is, do not, if you want to get back to coding, start a company. It's just, don't do it. If you have any fantasy you're going to do it, talk to me first. I'm not saying don't start a company. Just, don't be unrealistic about what you're going to do. It's about money, marketing, and sales. Technology is a distant runner in starting a company. It was interesting, though, because it was one of the very first commercial open source hybrid companies. There had been a few companies trying to do pure open source, but we were really kind of before Red Hat and so forth. I have an entire talk about starting a company, so I won't do any more right there. There was a lot of stuff driven largely by commercial needs more than open source needs in the commercial version. Encryption and authentication, Milter for mail filtering, virtual hosting, multiple logical queues, support for things like LDAP. As time went on, we had to do more and more checking because the world was becoming more and more hostile. So you had to start, for example, real-time black hole lists appeared somewhere in here because of all of those problems. So here's kind of the mail architecture today. There's SendMail in here as before. There's various services that can call it. It's got its queue. It's got the internet. There's a plethora of user interfaces are used today. There's multiple message stores, for example. There's, Cyrus IMAPD, which has its own message store. Exchange has its own message store. There's still this local mail spool and mail.local, but that doesn't get used that much in large installations. There's other services, SMS gateways, fax gateways, etc. And you've got side services like LDAP and Milters, and there's actually a whole plethora of those as well. Just the coding is blue is sort of homegrown stuff that I wrote or SendMail Inc. wrote. The yellow is stuff that was hacked at Berkeley. Purple is third-party software. Note that there are many, many protocols involved in this right now. The other interesting thing is this little Milters thing here. This is where all the interesting work is happening in mailers right now. MTAs are no longer of particular interest at all. So part two. So what? Who cares? So the first observation is that the requirements on SendMail changed quite dramatically over the years. At first, it started with reliability. The mail just had to get through. The old mail system wasn't particularly reliable. The mail system ate my grant proposal was a valid excuse, although that wasn't a popular one for me. you know, you basically had to get something done. It moved toward being about functionality and performance. How much mail can you shove through? What can you do with the mail, etc.? Spam and viruses came along. It turned from getting the mail in to keeping it out. And this was a really dramatic shift in the entire way you thought about MTAs. You know, before it was, I want to be sure everything gets reliably delivered. And we consciously made a decision right around here that we were going to give up reliability to get the protection. And the next kind of big wave was about legal and regulatory issues, archiving, data loss prevention, et cetera. And increasingly, as these things get established, it's about doing it as cheaply as possible. Running mail systems turn out to be surprisingly expensive. There's also, by the way, along with this controlling costs, there's some about integrating with other communication paradigms, so, you know, social networking being just the most obvious of them. So there's a certain amount going on there. So let me talk a little bit about the design decisions on SendMail and the evolution of the system. I've been criticized for all of these at one point or another. There was even a book out called The Unix Haters Handbook that had a chapter on SendMail that would take one feature of SendMail and criticize me for doing it this way, and then later on, for example, there was one about, you know, he didn't follow the standards, and so SendMail is wrong. And then the next page would be, he followed the standards, so SendMail is wrong. You know, there was just no winning. Some of these design decisions were, in fact, the right things to do. Some of them were probably just the wrong things to do. You know, you make mistakes sometimes. A whole bunch of them were right then, but as the requirements have changed, they've evolved to be not so right anymore. This is, by the way, in no sense an exhaustive list. First complaint is it's an overly general solution. You know, the good news with SendMail is you can do absolutely anything with it. The bad news is you can do absolutely anything with it. Somebody implemented Towers of Hanoi in the config language at one point. The reality was at the time the world was in flux. Things were changing on literally a day-to-day basis. Sometimes, I think this is actually just a good general rule, sometimes it is easier to build a tool than to build a solution to the problems. So you build, if you will, you solve. It's easier to solve a class of problems and then take the specialty than it is to solve a particular problem. And this has stood me well over the years. The reality is that the world is still ugly. Maybe not as ugly. It doesn't have, you know, percents and bangs and double colons and stuff like that. But you know, in retrospect, doing a more general solution was exactly the right thing to do. I wouldn't do it exactly the same way, but I would still do it. People don't like rewriting rules. They did seem like overkill at the time. All they really are is an ordered production system. It's pretty simple. It wasn't overkill at all. In fact, if anything, it may have been a little weak for what I needed to do it. There is one mistake. One absolute positive, absolute mistake, mea culpa, I'm sorry. Tabs, white space should not be active characters. There is very little semantic difference between a tab and a space as far as human beings and, more importantly, cut and paste in window systems than you might think. I'm getting there. The concept of rewriting rules was correct. All it really is a regular expression match replace, but instead of using characters, I'm using tokens. So I take, you know, really standard compiler technique, you run through a scanner first, and then you go from there. Other than that, it's really simple. Syntax, maybe not so. There was an attempt, by the way, to just use regular expressions. It's like, well, why is this so hard? It was something called OOPUS. It failed. The problem is that, of course, you know, there's a reason compilers use scanners instead of working on individual characters, and it's exactly the same reason. Message munging. It was absolutely essential for interoperability at the time. I didn't have a choice. Had to rewrite those addresses so you could reply to them. It is still heavily used, but the number of times when you need to do munging now is substantially lower. In retrospect, I suppose I'd have a pass-through mode, something that did no modification to the message at all, just put it through. But if you get something that's trash in, what do? Do you reject it, or do you pass it through as trash? Turns out there is no right answer to that question, or rather, there are two wrong answers to that question. The syntax of the configuration file. I can actually slow down a little bit here. Sorry. Each individual line was tagged with the essentially the syntax and semantics of that line. It was essentially flat. There was no nesting. Both of those decisions were to make it easy to parse at the time. And for example, essentially flat. I had no need for any kind of structure at the time. It turns out now it would be really nice to have more structure. So, for example, now that there's multiple queues, you'd like to have parameters on a per queue basis, and so forth. There was far too much use of single characters. You know, when you've got five or six options, who cares if they're single characters? There's, you know, percent %s, for example. Everyone knows s is string. Percent %d is decimal. Nobody complains that it's not percent %decimal because there's not so many of them. But as options came in, I should have more quickly recognized that it had to expand. Option names have, mailer flags have not. The configuration file is indeed ugly, I acknowledge that, but it's not fundamentally flawed. If I were going to do it today, I'd pick one of the known syntaxes and just reuse that. Embedding SMTP and queuing into sendmail. I only did that very reluctantly, but in retrospect, it was probably the right thing to do. I say definitely here, probably is more accurate. The need to double implement SMTP or some other such protocol, or alternatively give up on a lot of functionality, makes this, I think, the right decision. The queue uses two text files per message. One was for the envelope and header, and one was for the body. QF file, the one for the envelope and header, is just a series of individual lines. It looks almost exactly like a line printer daemon file of the time, and that's not an accident. In fact, it was also looked exactly like a UUCP daemon file and so forth and so on. That's just kind of the way it was done back then. Unfortunately, it does require a sequential scan of a lot of files. Now, when a system that has high mail load is getting, you know, dozens of messages every hour, it doesn't really matter. When it's getting hundreds or thousands per minute, then it becomes more of an issue. A lot could be done by caching, and in fact, SendMail does now do a fair amount of caching of these files, but in the ASCII format, I can't begin to tell you how great it is being able to just look at a file, not having to use a tool to look at a file, not having to use a tool that, by the way, has bugs in it, so you're debugging the wrong thing, and so forth and so on. Simple is good. In retrospect, it was, in fact, exactly the right thing to do at the time. I didn't waste a lot of time worrying about, putting things in a database. Oh, and by the way, robust embedded databases didn't exist. You know, there was no Berkeley DB. There was DBM, but DBM had a few little flaws, like if you filled up an index page, it just stopped inserting things, maximum size of records, etc. So there's ways I would change this. Using M4 for configuration. M4 was around. It was originally done as a preprocessor for, I believe, F77, the Fortran compiler. M4, by the way, is a follow-on to another macro processor called M6. I don't quite know why M4 is after M6, but M6 was truly awful. The syntax of M4 is kind of painful at times, mostly those, all those stupid quotes and stuff. But there really is no point in reinventing the wheel. DNLs, it turns out, I was much too obsessed with making the output of M4 look nice. instead of the input. And so the DNLs, all taking them out just results in blank lines in the resulting output file, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, I don't know. I was obsessed about it for some reason. I don't know if I'd use M4 again today. I'd look around at what else was available, but I wouldn't automatically rule M4 out. And, you know, I've got a soft spot in my heart for M4. Here's a big one. Extending versus changing features. This is one that companies go through all the time. It's a big, big question. An example here was masquerading. The first time it did masquerading, it solved the problem that was necessary at the time, but it turns out that for a lot of sites, it was a bigger problem. And so we added new features to extend masquerading onto other things like masquerade envelope and so forth and so on, for those of you who know it. And I didn't want to break, I didn't want to change the semantics of any existing sites. So, in other words, you know, if it works in one version and you update, it should work in the next version exactly the same way. In retrospect, that's part of the reason why SendMail is so hard to configure, because there's so many damn options. And in retrospect, I probably should have had fewer options. I should have been willing to break existing sites, maybe put in a feature to say, okay, do it the old way. But in fact, you just have to specify too much, because another way of putting this is the defaults are wrong, unfortunately. Once again, there is no right answer. Sometimes the right thing to do is to maintain back compatibility. Sometimes it's to break things. One of the reasons why Unix had been so beautifully elegant was because every new release of Unix, it broke everything. So, you know, I started on Unix version 4 barely. I was really only a babe in arms for version 4, so I should say version 5. Version 6 came along, and you had to rewrite all of your C code because the C language had changed. Literally, the language itself had changed between the releases because they examined it, and they said, you know, this feature isn't quite right. And instead of keeping it wrong, they said, we're going to make it right, and yes, that's going to cost something. And then version 7 comes along, and it's another... Let's go back and take Ingress at the time, for example, and we have to go through and do this sweep of the code so that it will compile under version 7. But it kept it small. It kept it beautiful. You can do that when it's a research project. You probably can't as a product. Here's an interesting one. There's something called the robustness principle, also known as Postel's law, which summarized is be liberal in what you accept and conservative in what you generate. This is actually it's a paraphrase from RFC, I think it's 793. It's the TCP spec. And it was accepted dogma for a long time. But some believe that SendMail, having taken this perhaps to an extreme, has permitted broken software to continue to exist, because since SendMail fixes things, i.e. it's very liberal in what it accepts and it's pretty conservative in what it generates, and you know what you do there is you either reject it or you fix it, and SendMail fixes it. It's not clear exactly what the right answer is, but if you want to hear more of my thinking about this, there's an article that I just, well, it's not quite done, that's going to appear in ACMQ in a couple months, specifically about this one question. Arguably, the robustness principle is obsolete. So what would I do differently today? Well, I would fix problems sooner, as soon as possible. I should say reasonably possible, because you can't do everything at once. The version 7 mailbox syntax, where messages are separated by FROM space, lines beginning with that. I did not invent that. That came from Bell Labs. It worked fine when bin mail was essentially a link to bin cat, which it effectively was. You just spit out the mailbox, and human beings parsed the headers such as they were. Headers meaning the FROM space line. That was the only header that had. Tabs in configuration files, definitely wrong. There were some bogus features, so forth. By the way, tabs and configuration files, Peter Salas alluded to this yesterday. One of the reasons I used tabs as active characters was because I was emulating Make, which used tabs as active characters. And several years later, I went to Stu Feldman, who wrote Make, and asked him about it. And he said, yeah, that was just the stupidest idea I ever made. You know. The other thing he said was, I had seven users, was things like dollar less than. It turns out it was a late night hack session. Somebody wanted this thing in. He couldn't think of anything mnemonic, so you know, at 3 in the morning, he just grabbed some special characters. And when he got in early in the morning, like 1 p.m. the next day, he discovered that there had been a distribution, so it was now on the seven machines, and so he decided it couldn't possibly change it. In retrospect, he admits that was wrong, too. At least if you're going to make mistakes, make the mistakes, same mistakes as somebody like Stu Feldman, right? I would use modern tools up to a point. Remember, I started this, Unix version 6. There weren't a lot of tools out there, so I had to build a lot of what you see in SendMail today, but only up to a point. I think people overuse tools sometimes. I'll get to that in a moment. I would use more privilege separation. The monolithic design of SendMail is in part due to the history of it, and there are other tools available right now. Oh, geez. I would definitely create a string abstraction. I love the C language. The worst thing about it is its handling of strings. The problem is if you create a string abstraction, then you have to wrap every call to any library routine in something to bundle it and unbundle it, and it's a real pain. At the time I started this, mailboxes and Unix user IDs were the same thing. They're not anymore, and so I would... This separation has been done in SendMail, but it's still... It doesn't quite fit properly yet. And, cleaner configuration file. Privilege separation, by the way, wouldn't be as extreme as postfix. Postfix, you start to look at it, it's got like 30 daemons running or whatever. Well, processes aren't as expensive as they're used to, but I don't know, it just offends my aesthetics for some reason. So what would I do the same today? I would use C as the implementation language. I like C. C's been good to me, and I like the fact that C does absolutely nothing behind the curtain. C++ does too many things behind the curtain. C++ is a terrible, terrible language, and no one should use it. I've been doing work recently in C++ and Java, and the more work I do on large systems, I'm becoming convinced that object orientation is, in fact, the problem, not the solution. Small appropriate use of object-oriented technology is the right thing to do, but taking it so that everything has to be an object requires unnatural acts, because some things just aren't objects, folks. I would still bite things off in smallish chunks. I'm not wild about agile programming. It works really, really well for certain kinds of things. But once again, agile programming is one of those things where once you buy into the religion, then you have to do all the things to make it work. And you start to say, well, for something that's supposed to be agile, there certainly is a lot of overhead to it. So once again, sometimes, but... it shouldn't be a religion. Syslog, I wrote Syslog as part of writing SendMail. That was absolutely one of the very, very best things I did, both for me in terms of debugging and long-term use. Everything runs Syslog today. It's absolutely the right thing to do. But keep it lightweight. Again, what's the problem and what's the solution? The trace facility in Java, which is essentially exactly the same as Syslog. Turns out, I did some profiling of a system, and 10% of the time was spent in the logger in this Java thing, because it's incredibly bloated. It's just this huge thing to log stuff to files. It makes no sense. Just incredibly stupid. And I wouldn't rely too heavily on outside tools. You know, don't use Lex where Stir-Toke is enough. People use these great big tools because they're there without thinking about whether they need that kind of power. Power has a cost, and people don't recognize that. So, takeaways. The KISS principle actually does work. Keeping it simple was very much the right thing to do. If you don't know what you're doing, advanced designs don't help very much. And I would argue that in some way, if you're working on a long software that's going to last for a long time, you never know what you're doing because tomorrow the world's going to change out from underneath you. The world is indeed a messy place, so you might as well plan on it now. Too many people start off by, you know, assuming this sweetness and light, and it doesn't work. Flexibility trumps performance when the world changes every day. Easy. This can also be kind of summarized as don't pre-optimize, etc. Fix things early. You know, if you succeed, your installed base only gets bigger, and so you're going to have the weight of not fixing those things, and that weight is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. If you fail, who cares anyway? You know, you might as well have done the right thing. I really am sorry I didn't understand this when I was younger. ASCII is really great for internal files and protocols. It really simplifies a lot of things. Sometimes you can't use it, but you know, ASN.1 is one of the great Bletcherisms of all civilization. You know, ASN.1 is designed on the principle that networks are slow and processors are fast, so we ought to pack as much as possible into a small number of bytes. It's just not true. On the other hand, I do have to say XML is maybe a little bit more to the opposite extreme, and there's got to be some balance. Documentation is absolutely a key to broad acceptance. I think one of the best things about FreeBSD is because of all the stuff that goes into the documentation project and the acceptance that people who write documentation are not, in fact, people who aren't smart enough to code or anything like that. They are, in fact, full-fledged members of the team, and that's really, really important. The design space is constantly changing, and it's changing in big ways. Let me give you a couple of examples. Virtual memory was this great insight that let you do time sharing on systems. The ability to do that moved us forward in great ways. Today, if you page, there's something wrong. Okay, virtual memory has turned from the solution into the problem. And I know people today who turn off virtual memory. They have zero swap space. By God, if they run out of physical memory, they want their program to crash so that they know that's it, because that's better than having it suddenly have a performance knee. So virtual memory, good, bad. Remember when it was so great that we had all of this flexibility and we could control our own lives and you didn't have to go and submit your card deck to, of course you don't remember that, to this centralized administration and there's a priesthood and whatnot. And now we have our own computer sitting on our own desk and we can do anything with it that we want. Cloud computing is nothing but a return to that old centralized administration that we thought was so sucky. Okay. Now, does that say that cloud computing is a mistake? Once again, I think cloud computing is perhaps a fad that, you know, if you think of everything as a cloud, cloud computing is always the answer. I don't know. It's the right thing in some cases. It is not a panacea. And it is a return. We are giving up our own power over our own destiny to other companies, people we do not know. As long as you accept that and understand what that means, it's fine. But don't pretend that you have control anymore. You've given it away. And this, by the way, is based on a chapter of a book coming out hopefully in a few weeks called The Architecture of Open Source Applications. And it's, you know, not just about SendMail. It's got a whole bunch of chapters, each written by somebody who's written some big piece of open source software. I'm looking forward to it. Actually, it should be a pretty interesting book. And thank you. Any questions? Yeah.
Earlier you said that the robustness principle was obsolete. How would you upgrade it?
How would I upgrade the robustness principle? Well, I'm tempted to make a joke and say, be conservative in what you accept and liberal in what you generate. But, you know, I think a lot of the reason is that the robustness principle worked great if you were talking about people passively making implementation mistakes. And so you wanted to do interoperation. It did not. It started to break down when you got to active attackers who were trying to see how they could slip in through the backside. So one of the big concerns about it is a security issue, and that's legitimate. I think the right answer is it still makes sense, for example, for user interfaces. You know, nobody wants to have to tell their users that, oh, by the way, they have to, you know, put a comma in the right place in numbers or anything like that. You can afford to be flexible in that. On the other hand, you know, if there's a quote character inside some input data, you probably don't want to accept that. That's the beginnings of an injection attack. So it's like so many things, it depends. And you've got to be reasonable about it. Yes? I have not really looked at Go in enough detail to be able to form an opinion. I saw a talk that he gave about it that sounded really encouraging, and I particularly liked the thing about, you know, he wants programming to be fun again. You know, I do have to say, having started SendMail, was an executive for over 10 years. It is really true, being an executive does rot your brain. And I went back to try and do engineering, and it's really hard. Part of why it's hard, though, is that programming has changed from what I think of as programming as, you know, problem solving, to doing integration of all of these libraries, which is one of the reasons I'm flaming so much about the tools, because, you know, when the tools become the point, you know, the continuous integration tools, I can't tell you how much time gets spent trying to convince the continuous integration tools to pass legitimate stuff rather than focusing on getting it done. It's about feeding the tool, not about solving the problem. And so a little bit of resentment there, I suppose. But, you know, I admit it, I'm not as good a coder as I used to be. I do find I can still program in C moderately well. But I've always had a bad memory, and when programming comes down to how large how many libraries can you memorize the APIs to, I'm terrible at that, just terrible. So I don't know. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. I think so.
Okay. Yes.
What do you think about the future of mail?
Can we get rid of mail? No. Can we get rid of the fax machine? Can we get rid of the telephone? No. No, can't. Well, fax machine might be subsumed into mail at some point. Telephone isn't going to go away; it's going to morph. But you know, every time you use Skype, you're using the telephone. You know, fundamentally, VoIP is the telephone. It's just the transport protocol that's changed. Email, people are saying, oh well, you just use Facebook. You know, if you're sending around corporate documents, you do not post them on Facebook. It's not going to happen. There's going to be a place for email for a long, long time. Is it going to change to the point where it may be almost unrecognizable? Yeah, that is going to do, just as the telephone doesn't look anything like that black thing that was around when I was a kid. Totally different, but it's got a future. Yes? Okay, so the question is there any hope for standards compliant mail? That's part of the robustness principle question. You know, as long as we permit these things to exist, they will continue to go on. But, you know, the other thing I have to say is the great things about standards is there's so many to choose from. You know, Microsoft has their set of standards. Okay, if you go exchange to exchange, it works great. And as long as you stay within that walled garden, no problem. You know, I use what is now a really old mailer called Mulberry. One of the reasons I use it is because it is absolutely the most standards compliant mailer that I've ever found out there. And it's really good. And it's fast and so forth. Unfortunately, it's no longer supported and it's starting to show its age. And I'm going to have to find something else, which I'm not looking forward to. So, you know, HTML, by the way, didn't just come out of nowhere. It started from SGML. SGML is 50 years old or 40 years old or something like that. And, oh, God, you do not want to read the SGML specs. Hold on. Let me see. Anyone on this side of the room? Okay, you're up.
What about SendMail X?
What about SendMail X? SendMail X was, originally I wanted to do a major rewrite on SendMail to do some re-architecture inside. For various reasons, I couldn't really get the time to do the coding on that. It went to Klaus Ausmann, who works at SendMail Inc. Klaus, I wanted to do incremental changes, which would involve things like swapping out the config file and a lot of the stuff I talked about here, fixing all of that. He wanted to start from a blank piece of paper. And he ended up getting something that sort of worked. Well, it does work as long as you don't want to do too much. But it took him like 3 or 4 years to do that. And it was still nowhere near what we needed for anything that would fit the commercial needs. And at some point we just said we can't continue to invest in this. So it's still up as open source. I don't really know all that much about it. Like I said, I personally would have done it differently. It looks a lot like PostFix, maybe yeah. Too much like PostFix. I will say, by the way, before PostFix came out, I was at a conference and saw Vitsa in the audience and went back, sat down next to him, and you know, usual how things going. I said, so how's the mailer going? And he said, it's taking longer than expected. It did. It took him like 3 years longer than he thought it was going to. And said, it's harder than it looks, isn't it? He said, it's been an exercise in humility. So Vitsa and I are actually friends. I like Vitsa. You know, I'm maybe a little envious of him, but I don't resent him in any sense. He did good work. Any other questions? Yes.
Why can't we
defeat spam? Ha ha ha, why can't we defeat spam? We can. All we have to do is completely change the model of email entirely right now mail is basically permissive. By default, the mail goes through. If we change it so the only mail that I will accept into my mailbox is from people that I already know and who have cryptographically authenticated, which we can do, then you could defeat spam. The problem is that one of the great things about email is being able to communicate with people you do not have a pre-existing relationship with. And that, I think, is one of the really important things. You know, trust me, no sales department of any company is going to want to reject the email from the potential customer saying, you know, please call to, you know, get my, you know, tell me about your product. Any more than they're going to refuse to answer the telephone from numbers they don't recognize. Now, some people do that. Maybe we need the equivalent of caller ID. Microsoft went so far as to actually call it that at one point until they got a cease and desist. But to be honest, I think of spam as one of those problems. It's not solved, but it's at a point where it's manageable enough that it's not killing us day by day. I'm not an ISP. So, you know, I might feel differently if I were dealing with it every day. I do keep all of my spam coming in. I have an idea of what the loads are. They're truly, you know, I personally get, probably about 60,000 spams a month, something like that. You know, hundreds a day on a good day. But it doesn't bother me that much. Spam Assassin's gotten to the point where it's usable. Throw that on that a Bayesian filter in your mail program. You can live with it. Gray listing delays mail, and it's actually not that hard to get around if you know what's going on. And it also breaks legitimate mail patterns. So, for example, Gmail isn't always going to send from the same IP address. When it does a retry, it's going to come from some other IP address in their pool. So it breaks stuff like that. And gray listing works because few enough people are using it that it hasn't been worth it to the spammers to adapt to it. And the problem with pretty much all of the anti-spam tools is that they have gone through the following thought process. Oh, look, spammers do this. Let's block that. And then spammers go, oh, they blocked that. Let's go over here and do this. Oh, spammers are now using that. Let's block that. And, you know, we keep driving the cost to receive mail up and up and up, and we haven't done a damn thing to make it more expensive for them to send it. So this is one of the reasons why it's becoming increasingly expensive to run a mail system. Yes, in back. Mention Postfix. Do I have any comments on Qmail? No. That it? Okay, thank you.